Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the June 15th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Andrew Tate's Empire of Abuse by Haiti Blake. A reporter at large, Andrew Tate's Empire of Abuse, how the defining figure of the manosphere built a fortune and became a political force by systemically exploiting women. By Heidi Blake. Just north of Bucharest is a neat development of red-gabled houses known as American Village. It is an unlikely place to be the center of an international criminal intrigue, but on its western border is a sprawling compound patrolled by armed guards that belongs to the British-American influencer Andrew Tate and his younger brother Tristan. The Tates moved to Romania a decade ago to build an online pornography empire, and American Village was where they kept their recruits. One day in April 2022, Ismaina Penkoff was in a villa near the compound recovering from surgery. A slender, dark-haired former psychology student, she had met Andrew Tate the previous year and agreed to move across Romania to be with him. Tate had told Penkoff that he considered her his wife, and when he first asked her to strip on camera, she was appalled. "I'm old-fashioned, and I do believe in God," she texted him. "My body is intimate, and only my husband should be able to touch and see." But he had worn her down, identified the objections, and destroyed them, he wrote in private messages, describing her recruitment. "She never believed in God. Women never believe in anything." Tate presided over an online network called The War Room, in which, for a fee of about $8,000 a year, he promised to free the modern man from socially induced incarceration. Members learned how to recruit women into sexual slavery in a series of tutorials that Tate called his PhD or Pimping Hose degree. He had used Penkoff as a teaching case, reporting on her subjugation over the secure messaging app Telegram. "I've done this with over 100 girls," he told members. "I almost sound evil, but I'm not. I'm a shepherd leading the sheep." Penkoff had become an online sex worker who staged live shows through the night and posted pornography on OnlyFans. The Tates had paid to have her teeth fixed and then to have her breasts enlarged. The words Tate owned were tattooed in swirling letters across her upper arm, along with a cobra, Andrew's personal insignia. She remained passionately devoted to him. "I love you enough to fight for you, compromise for you, and sacrifice myself for you," she texted him. Penkoff was not alone in her devotion. The Tates used the same method to recruit all the women who came to American Village. "You have to fuck them, and they have to love you. It's essential to the business," Andrew explained in a video he sold to War Room members. "You have to be militant with your fucking pimping." I have pieced together an account of Tate's activities from thousands of private messages, internal documents, sealed prosecutorial files, and court records, as well as scores of interviews with the Tates, their associates, and more than a dozen alleged victims. The Tates had moved to Romania from the United Kingdom in 2015 after three British women accused Andrew of rape and strangulation, and the brothers seemed to operate there with impunity. Court records show that local police sat on at least two reports indicating that the Tates were coercing Romanian women into sex work. Andrew openly discussed bribing law enforcement officials in war room chats and bragged on social media about his connections. "Everyone wants to be friends with the pimp," he wrote in a since-deleted tweet. "Doubt me? Epstein had access to pussy. Look at his fucking friends list." Penkoff had been entrusted with supervising new arrivals at a villa in American Village where the brothers housed sex workers. Tate called her his mafia wife and told her, "It's important you and I work together and just control them all." She had become an eager accomplice. "We're the power team," she told him. Penkoff was concerned about the latest recruit, a 20-year-old aspiring musician who Tristan Tate had romanced on a recent trip to Miami. The musician had refused to strip on camera, insisting that she had come to Bucharest to teach Tristan piano. Penkoff found her demeanor weird and secretive. She had caught her talking furtively in her bedroom with another reticent newcomer. That day in 2022, Penkoff heard a hammering at the front door. Another recruit went to answer it, and a voice asked if the American woman was inside. When the worker said yes, there followed a cacophony of voices, radios, and pounding boots as police stormed the property. It turned out that, soon after arriving in Bucharest, the American had begun sending distressing messages back home. "These guys are actually evil," she had written. "They are definitely trafficking women." "The other women in the house seemed brainwashed," she said. The U.S. Embassy was alerted and swiftly notified local police. A SWAT team was deployed to take the women in the villa to protective custody. The Tates were questioned, and one of Romania's leading organized crime prosecutors opened an investigation into suspected human trafficking. But the brothers were quickly released, and Andrew waved away reports of the incident, claiming that it had been a prank. He had been saying for years that he was above the law, and he saw no reason to doubt it now. At the time of the raid, Andrew Tate was on the cusp of becoming one of the most famous men on the planet. He'd amassed a vast following on social media, mixing posts about diamond watches, cigars, and supercars with jokes and misogynistic rants. He told alienated young men that they were the victims of a feminized society determined to crush their male essence, and urged them to get fit, rich, and reclaim their natural masculine imperative for power. Often, that imperative seemed to equate to sexual violence. In one video, Tate described the basic moves of pimping while lying on his bed waving a machete. Bang out the machete, boom, in her face, then grip her up by the neck, he said. The machete's on the floor, her panties are all wet, and you go fuck her. That's how it goes. Slap, slap, grab, choke, slap, shut up, bitch, sex. Tate had risen to prominence in the online realm of incels, pickup artists, and red pill believers known as the Manosphere, and he'd engineered an ingenious way to expand his reach. Not long before the raid, he had launched Hustlers University, an online school that, for $49.99 a month, taught modern wealth creation methods, including an affiliate marketing program that functioned as a gigantic content factory. Members were given access to a library of Tate's videos and earned commissions by reposting clips to attract new subscribers. More than 160,000 students enrolled, pumping Tate's content into algorithms already primed to amplify extreme ideas. In the months after the raid, videos tagged hashtag Andrew Tate were viewed more than 12 billion times on TikTok alone, and he became one of the world's most Googled people. His followers spread his rhetoric to millions of homes and classrooms. Teenage boys around the world barked Tate's slogan, "Make me a sandwich," at female teachers and reporters spread of sexual aggression by his followers. Tate's enormous reach made him a political force. He had always been an enthusiastic supporter of Donald Trump. "He's grabbing bitches by the pussy. I like that guy," he'd said once. And he became a singularly influential proponent of masculinism, a creed devoted to countering feminism and restoring the patriarchy that helped unite the disparate factions of the MAGA coalition. Tate called for women to be stripped of the vote, barred from the workplace, and forced to procreate. By comparison, conservative politicians' efforts to erode reproductive rights and roll back gender equality laws seem moderate. "I have shifted the Overton window heavily since I became famous," Tate bragged. In the summer of 2022, feminist and anti-fascist groups mounted a campaign to deplatform Tate, and he was ejected from mainstream social media. But the bans only enhanced his fame, with conservative pundits hailing him as a free speech martyr. "We're adults and Americans, and we'll listen to anyone we want," Tucker Carlson said as he welcomed Tate onto his Fox News show. Tate played his part adroitly. "When someone who's championing men's issues like myself comes forward and finally manages to garner huge percentiles of the public support, I'm silenced," he said. Tate made a deal with the right-wing streaming service Rumble, which had recently received major investments from Peter Thiel, the tech billionaire, and J.D. Vance, Trump's future vice president. The details have not previously been confirmed, but a confidential contract shows an agreement to pay Tate at least $6 million a year for a weekly quota of 5 short videos and 30-minute live stream. His presence inspired a 45% increase in active users, sending Rumble to first place on the Apple and Google charts. A few months later, Elon Musk bought Twitter and reinstated Tate's account. When Tate was arrested on human trafficking charges, his allies defended him. Donald Trump Jr. called the case absolute insanity, and Musk suggested that the authorities were targeting the Tates while ignoring actual sex trafficking. Carlson, who had just released a documentary called The End of Men, devoted hours of airtime to proclaiming Tate's innocence. So did the right-wing podcaster Candace Owen. The activist Charlie Kirk praised him on stage. "What he says is so powerful," Kirk said. "Our society is configured toward collapsing the American man." Prosecutors went on to allege that the Tates had trafficked dozens of women by using romantic relationships to lure them into sex work. Though the brothers were released from custody, they were barred from leaving Romania. Tate issued a defiant statement, "The Matrix has attacked me, but they misunderstand. You cannot kill an idea." To fight the charges, he hired an expensive team of lawyers, PR operatives, and private detectives. Tate's representatives claimed that he hadn't really meant what he'd said online about sexually exploiting women. He had simply been playing a character for entertainment. At the same time, they devised a campaign to attack his accusers with scores of legal filings, while Tate's affiliate network harassed and smeared them online. Each one of his team members described it as textbook victim intimidation. As the 2024 U.S. election approached, the team saw an opportunity. Tate forged relationships with Barron Trump and Donald Trump Jr. In the weeks before the vote, he pumped out pro-MAGA content, mobilizing young men in such large numbers that Kamala Harris later named him as a key factor in her defeat. When the result was in, Tate posted jubilantly on X, "The patriarchy is back." After the inauguration, he added, "The Tates will be free. Trump is the president." Weeks later, under pressure from the U.S., Romania lifted the Tates travel ban. Since then, the brothers have traveled the world, while the case appears stalled and the evidence remains sealed. "When I met them earlier this year at a cigar lounge in Bucharest, they assured me that the prosecution was doomed. It's just garbage out of a corrupt country," Andrew said, puffing a Davidoff and flashing pearly veneers. "Show me a victim. Show me a hurt girl. Show me a bruise. Show me a girl chained up. Show me something. The times I struck a woman in passion, I never left a mark," the Tate's father wrote on Facebook in 2011. "Super control of the human animal. They love me still." Emery Tate was a celebrated black chess master who served as a staff sergeant and a linguist in the U.S. Air Force. He met their mother, a white British woman named Eileen Ashley, on a brief posting to the U.K. The couple married and moved to America, and in 1986, Andrew was born in a military hospital in Washington, D.C. Tristan came a year and a half later, followed by his sister Janine. Andrew has described his father's influence in scores of posts, podcasts, and videos. "My dad was my hero in every way," he has said. "I feared my dad as if he was God himself." Emery was brilliant, charismatic, and mercurial. In 1992, he was discharged from the Air Force after being diagnosed as having conditions that interfere with military service, including narcissistic personality disorder. Back in civilian life, he was convinced that he was being monitored by the CIA, that the family car was being tailed, and that he was under attack by assailants from Eastern Europe. "The world he lived in was a scary world," Andrew has said. He remembered Emery telling him, "You're a Tate. You're going to come. They're going to come for you like they came for me." The family relocated to Elkhart, Indiana, to be close to Emery's mother. The brothers spent hours playing around their grandmother's house, climbing trees, building forts, and racing through cornfields, but their home life was fraught. Emery drank heavily and was prone to terrifying rages. Tristan told me that if he stepped out of line, his father beat him with a belt, sometimes whipping him until his skin was striped red. Andrew has described lying awake at night in terror. "I must have been the most awake child on earth," he said in one video. "I was so afraid of the beatdown." In his telling, this violence was an essential part of becoming a man. "I can't wait to kick my kid's ass if he gets fresh," he has said. In Indiana, Emery worked a low-wage job at McDonald's, a car wash, a park, but funneled his ferocious intellect into chess, often staying up all night drinking and practicing variations. He started leaving the family to play in tournaments around the country. He would arrive by bus wearing his trademark trilby and hustle for spare dollars in chess parks. A dazzling, attacking player, he became a folk hero on the circuit, bringing the flair and swagger to chess, often seen on the basketball courts, the chess writer Daim Shabazz noted. But he lacked the discipline to reach grandmaster level, where serious winnings kick in. "As smart as my father was, chess doesn't pay," Andrew has said. He also loved gambling, women, and booze. "So you add all that up, we were very, very poor." When Emery returned to the family after an 8-week absence, Eileen confronted him over an infidelity, and he walked out again. "When you're older, you'll understand," he told Andrew. "Your mother won't shut up." As the marriage broke down, Andrew rationalized his father's abandonment. "You're a better role model to your son if you barely see him and live life on your own terms," he later wrote. "A dad is a superhero, not a full-time carer. Don't sit and become a bitch like the woman wants." In 1997, the year Andrew turned 11, Eileen moved the children to her hometown of Luton, an impoverished and overcrowded municipality north of London. They stayed in a hostel for homeless women and children. "It was a horrible place to live," Tristan told me. Eileen got a job washing dishes in a school cafeteria, and he remembered that her hands were always bleeding and cracked. Eventually, they moved to the Marsh Farm Estate, a housing project plagued by crime and violent riots. The Tates went to a failing school where they were bullied for their American accents and shabby clothes. Emery occasionally sent money, and the brothers would walk to a payphone to call him. "My father raised me over the phone," Andrew has written. "I was still afraid of him 3,000 miles away." As a teenager, Andrew was dogged by a feeling of unease. "I always had this sense that something wasn't quite right about the way the world functioned," he has said. He thought of himself like the character Neo in The Matrix, restlessly searching without knowing what for. When the brothers walked to school together, they sometimes saw a Ferrari drive by, and Andrew became furious. "He's hacked The Matrix," he said. "How does he have 400 grand for a car? He knows something we don't." By 17, Andrew had left school and was working in a fish market, waking up at dawn to log boxes of ice. He described being encumbered by a crippling, perpetual boredom that yielded only to danger. Seeking a remedy, he enrolled in a kickboxing gym run by a former Special Forces soldier from Bosnia. Soon he was competing, and Tristan started training too. Kickboxing is not much more lucrative than professional chess. The brothers initially fed themselves on canned sardines and chicken scrounged from abandoned KFC buckets. But in the ring, Andrew exhibited his father's gift for showmanship. He called himself King Cobra, got a cobra tattooed on his chest, and developed a patter about drinking snake blood. In one post-match interview, he was red-faced and furious, fumbling with his mouthguard. "This is not sport to me," he seethed. "I'm in there to kill. That's it. Pain. That's all I know." As Tate's fighting career gathered momentum, his father showed an interest. In 2011, Andrew won his first world championship, and Emery wrote online, "Destruction itself rides in his very fingertips." He also posted musings that seemed to provide his son with an ideological roadmap. He warned against enemies of alpha males, the Matrix, and the insanity of the ruling elite. He mocked the notion of gender equality and argued that mature men would be allowed to have sex with pubescent with girls. Emery was still traveling between chess tournaments, and his posts were interspersed with blurry photos of hotels and dark city streets. He wrote about drinking vodka at 3 a.m. and inhabiting a state between ennui and dejection. At times, his tone was valedictory. I could clone myself. I would not, he wrote. The better versions of me already walk on the planet. At others, it approached introspection. Many animals are immune to their own poison, he wrote in 2012. The toxic human releases that his toxin kills even himself, toxifies his kids. He died 3 years later, succumbing to a heart attack during a chess match. Andrew posted a tribute. He created a monster, he wrote, as a father should. At the peak of Tate's fighting career, he spent part of each year competing across Europe, and he often based himself in Kosice, Slovakia, an elegant medieval city of pastel townhouses and Gothic spires. During one visit, he met Bibiana Horoskova, a high school student with hazel eyes and blonde hair, who was working as a waitress. Tate has said that they met in 2012, the year he turned 26 and she turned 15. He had taken to collecting girlfriends on his travels, and Horoskova became one of them. I had a girlfriend in Slovakia, and I had a girlfriend in France, I had a girlfriend in England, he later wrote. Do they know about each other? No. Horoskova was besotted with Tate. You're the best thing ever happened to me, she texted him. I want babies and get married. In 2014, when she turned 17, Tate summoned her to England. She left her family and went. By then, Tate was three-time kickboxing world champion, but even at the top of the sport, he generally made only about $50,000 for a title fight. After he paid his manager and his trainer, there was little left over. In early 2014, he sat down to make a list of everything he owned. It was a dispiriting exercise. He and his brother shared a rundown apartment with barely any furniture. He owed money on his car, but then he had what he considered a flash of entrepreneurial genius. I had about five girlfriends, all smoking hot, and females are an asset, he recalled in a video. Pussy is the only reason that empires were started and wars were waged. I had to find a way to monetize the assets. Tate knew some street pimps, and he contemplated that route, but he didn't want other men touching what he saw as his property. Opening a strip club was too expensive. Then he stumbled on an ad for a webcam porn site. He flew all his girlfriends to Lutton and assembled them at a restaurant where they learned of one another's existence. I said, listen, young ladies, I'm starting a webcam business, Tate later recalled. This is going to change your life. Most of the women left, but Horoska stayed. Tate set up a profile for her on a site called My Free Cams, which allowed users to watch models for free, then pay them to perform specific sex acts or private shows. Filming sex imagery of anyone under 18 is illegal in the U.S. and the U.K. On camera, Horoska became a Russian woman in her 20s, performing under the username Kiss of a Cobra. Tate persuaded her to get a tattoo of a cobra down one side of her body and another reading Tate Property above her crotch. Webcam porn, now a multi-billion-dollar industry, was then a nascent phenomenon, and Tate considered himself a pioneer. We started doing 15, 16, 17-hour days, he said. I'd wake up, go piss, and by the time I'd finished pissing, I was awake enough to say, all right, 2 hours sleep, that's enough. He realized that he could extract bigger tips from customers if he wrote them seductive messages off camera while Horoska pretended to type on a disconnected keyboard. I had these guys selling their houses, life savings, loans, all of it, he later said. I put together an apparatus of genius behind the avatar of beauty, and we fucking conquered. With Tate controlling her performances, Hrefska became a fan favorite. I think I've fallen in love again, one user wrote. For a price, Tate would have sex with her on camera. In one video, he keeps his face out of view as he penetrates Hrefska from behind, but the distinctive cobra tattoo on his chest and arm is clearly visible. She will perform anal sex in front of hundreds of viewers who will keep tipping to push her boundaries, a review site noted. Tate has claimed that in the first month with Hrefska on camera, he made more than $100,000. The brothers bought an Aston Martin. That April, Andrew won the kickboxing world championship for a fourth time, but he soon stepped back from the sport to focus on expanding his webcam business, telling a kickboxing magazine that he was now a pimp superstar. As Tate warmed to his new career, he adopted a motto. There are only two categories of people, pimps and hoes. He was quoting the infamous Chicago pimp Ken Ivey, who published a book called Pimpology and another titled The Art of Human Chess. Tate studied both volumes closely. Seduction is a chess game, and to the victor goes the spoils, Ivy wrote in a treatise on recruiting sex workers. To master someone completely, they have to depend on you for everything, he instructed. Most hoes have low self-esteem for a reason. A pimp looks for that weakness, and if it isn't on the surface, he brings that motherfucker out of them. Webcam work, unlike prostitution, is generally legal. But it is illegal almost everywhere in the world to recruit sex workers using force, fraud, or coercion, including psychological manipulation. Tate wasn't concerned. As he started searching for new recruits, he bought a replica of the glove that featured in O.J. Simpson's murder trial and got the word pimp embroidered on the palms. At the end of 2014, he reached out on Facebook to a 20-year-old British woman whom I'll call Maya Navarro. He sent a recruiting video of Hrefska sprawled on a bed, tapping on a keyboard. Just typing to some guys is the easiest money in the world, he said. Navarro was living with her mother, who had worked for years in a warehouse, and a younger brother who had learning difficulties. Her father had recently become homeless, and since leaving school, she had been precariously employed. She agreed to meet Tate for coffee to find out more. Navarro told me that Tate was very charismatic, very confident. He showed her screenshots of the money coming into Hrefska's webcam account and said that he would make her rich so that she could travel the world and help her family. I don't think I'd ever spoken to anyone in my entire life that had said those kind of things to me, Navarro told me. Soon afterward, Tate picked Navarro up from her mother's house and drove her to a block of apartments above a convenience store. Up a dark stairway lit by a flickering bulbs, he showed her into a room with a mattress on the floor and a computer station in the corner. It was skanky, she told me, but Tate assured her that they would soon be moving to a penthouse. He plied her with wine and directed her to lie on the mattress, pretending to type while he messaged customers from the computer. That first night, he let her keep her underwear on, and it didn't feel so bad. When Tate picked her up for the second shift, there was a young woman, whom I'll call Amelia Walker, in the back seat. Navarro knew Walker a little from school and felt more at ease with her there. Between stints on camera, they laughed and drank bottles of rosé that the brothers supplied. At the end of the week, Tate gave each woman several hundred pounds in cash, more than Navarro had ever held. She said that he drove them to a shopping center and declared, "You've got money now. Start spending it." Navarro bought a Michael Kors watch and, after a few more shifts, a pair of Louboutin heels. It was such a thrill that she kept the receipt as a trophy. "I felt really, really proud of myself," she said. "It was kind of like, oh, this is what my life can be like if I stay here." But Tate was already coming to resent paying Navarro and Walker a cut of their earnings. Hrefska let him keep 100% of the fucking money, he later said. But he complained. "Once you get bigger, you start hiring girls who don't love you." He decided on a strategy. "I have a financial incentive to fuck as many as I can." Before long, Tate told Navarro and Walker, "You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan." Now continuing on with our story. They would now be working from a room in a Hilton hotel in Lutton. On the second night, the woman fell asleep in there, and Navarro said she woke up to find Tate behind her, touching her legs. Then she said he pulled down her underwear and grabbed her throat, forcing himself inside her. "You're such a good little girl," she remembered him saying, while he choked her until she struggled for breath. Navarro said that she repeatedly told Tate to stop and tried to loosen his grip on her throat, but he continued. Navarro recalls that she passed out afterward and woke up beside Tate feeling disgusting, ashamed, dirty. She left and returned to her mother's house, but resuming normal life was hard. "My crappy house, my crap bedroom, and my tiny little bed. That definitely put it into perspective," she said. "Slowly, I was like, I should go back because that's the most money I've ever made." She told herself she'd be firmer with Tate. "I was like, maybe he won't do it again. Maybe he'll just leave me alone." By March 2015, Tate had moved his webcam operation to Hitchin, a market town outside Lutton. He'd rented an airy four-bedroom apartment with a roof terrace overlooking a quaint stone church and a riverbank of willows. When Navarro returned, she thought that it was the nicest place she'd ever stayed. Tate was now calling Amelia Walker his girlfriend, and they were sharing a bed. Navarro found Walker spirited and funny, a good companion. "She kind of made the place like home," she told me. The two women retreated to the rooftop whenever they got a break to smoke, joke around, and get some sun. Tate had hung up a poster commissioned from a local artist. It depicted him on a throne, holding a cane that he called his pimp stick, with three women leaning over him in stilettos and thongs. "Big Tate carries a cane to keep his hoes sane," it said in pink bubble writing. He had also had a poster made for his brother, who was recruiting webcam workers of his own. Tristan's poster depicted him dressed as a buccaneer. Above the words, "The captain's word is law," Navarro said that Tristan would walk around the apartment wearing a tricorn hat and waving a foam sword, declaring, "I am the captain of the money ship." There was an absurdity to it all that took the edge off the menace. There were half a dozen women working in the apartment, including Huskova, whom Navarro recognized from the video that Tate had sent. "Tate was horrible to Huskova," Navarro said, calling her fat and ugly. When he was around, Huskova seemed to vie for his attention, trying to be the alpha female in the house. When he was gone, though, she seemed like she didn't want to be there, but she was scared. The hours were grueling, and Navarro downed several bottles of wine during each shift, trying to stay disinhibited enough to do what customers asked. By the time she finished, she was drunk and desperate for sleep. At first, the brothers drove her home, but after a while, she said they refused, and she had to sleep over. There were only two beds in the apartment, and Tristan slept upstairs with several women he'd recruited, so Navarro ended up crashing in the bed that Walker shared with Tate. One morning, Navarro woke up to Tate and Walker having sex next to her. She shushed them, and Walker got up and went into the bathroom. When she was gone, Navarro said, Tate put her in a chokehold and raped her for a second time. Though she clawed at his arms, he wouldn't release his grip. "I was so scared that he was going to kill me," she told me. Then Walker emerged from the shower and he rolled off her. Later, Navarro said she was working on camera when she heard strange sounds and went to investigate. Through the open bedroom door, she saw Tate strangling Walker on the bed. Walker's face was red and puffy, and her body was limp. Navarro said, "She felt a strange paralysis. I was like, there's nothing I can do about it," she told me. She went back to work. The following morning, Navarro and Walker were putting on makeup in the bathroom when they noticed clusters of red spots around their eyes. Walker searched online and saw that petechia, burst blood vessels, can be a sign of acute pressure in the head from strangulation. The women began to panic, hearing a commotion. The Tates came to the door. When they saw the marks, they laughed. "You're such dumb bitches," Navarro remembers their saying. "They're from sleeping on the silk sheets." Navarro said that Tate started attacking her at random moments. Multiple times when she slept late, he whipped her with a belt. Time became a blur, and the world outside the apartment seemed to recede. But one day, Navarro had a moment alone, and something snapped. She walked out the door and never went back. Walker left soon afterward, and the two women gradually began talking about what had happened. Though Walker had started sleeping with Tate consensually, she said that he had attacked her many times, choking her till she almost passed out. That summer, the women contacted the Hertfordshire police. As it happened, Tate was already known to the authorities. The previous spring, another woman had gone to the police to make similar allegations. The woman, whom I'll call Hannah Price, said that she had briefly dated Tate the previous year, but told him that she wasn't ready for sex. In the course of several weeks, she said he raped and strangled her twice. Price showed police a series of messages from Tate discussing the alleged assaults. "I love raping you," had written to her. "Monsters are monsters." Tate says he did not strangle any of the women and that the sex was consensual, but he has repeatedly advocated throttling women during sex as a way to assert masculine power. "Choke her so she can barely fucking breathe. Tell her she's yours forever," he said in one podcast. "You just have to be large enough force to program her." Price and Walker declined to be interviewed, but have described being assaulted by Tate in court filings. Tate was arrested on suspicion of assault, but he denied everything and was quickly released. Back at the apartment, he arranged for several webcam workers to give statements on his behalf. "We're going to bury this shit and carry on with our lives," he told them. Then, before the case could move forward, he and Tristan left for Romania. "Fuck England," Tate said. "I'm bouncing." The Tate's compound outside Bucharest lies behind heavy security gates. Inside is a courtyard with an underlit swimming pool and a line of parked supercars, Aston Martins, Lamborghinis, and Bugattis. The house is a vast converted warehouse clad in gleaming black panels with the name Tate mounted on the wall in huge white letters next to an emblem of a chess knight. A wrought iron samurai statue stands by a bulletproof door. "When I visited this March, Tristan showed me around. He is physically imposing, 6 feet four and around 230 pounds, but his manners were polished. He ushered me into a cavernous space where the brothers' kickboxing belts hung on a wall alongside a photograph of their father. Glass-topped display tables held a replica handgun, gold bullets, and brass knuckles. In a wood-paneled cigar lounge, Tristan showed me a towering safe sheathed in burgundy leather, which he said contained watches and millions of dollars in cash and gold before the raid. Security cameras covered every inch of the compound except the bedrooms. "I've made it into a fortress," he said. In 2015, when the Tates decided to leave England, Andrew's plan was, "I'll just run around the world and I'll be above the jurisdiction of any one place." Then a friend from his kickboxing days called from Romania. Sebastian Veru ran a mixed martial arts company with backing from two brothers, Mihate and Soren Dorefti, who were later indicted for heading one of the largest criminal cartels in Romanian history. They denied the allegations. Tate was fascinated by his friend's connections. He became a partner in the cage fighting business and then began investing in real estate. Tate boasted in texts about how easy it was to hide cash in Romanian property. "Turn up with money in a bag," he wrote. "No banks, no mortgage, no bullshit, no tax." He later partnered with the Durfrentis to open a series of casinos, which he described as big-time mafia shit. To Tate, Romania seemed like a gangster's paradise. He bragged about bribing officials, filling his house with guns and machetes, and hiding money from the authorities through cryptocurrency. He repeatedly claimed to have used mafia and police contacts to hunt down people who had crossed him. "Please do not underestimate how connected I am in Romania," he tweeted. "MPs, police chiefs, street thugs, anything can be fixed." The Tates had brought Hruscova and several other women from the UK and put them to work in properties around Bucharest. They hired a former member of Romania's security services, who recruited dozens of guards to protect them. Tate said that he also consulted a local lawyer about the potential implications of being accused of assaulting a woman, and was assured that without physical evidence, she would have no case. This is probably 40% of the reason I moved to Romania, because in Eastern Europe, none of this garbage flies. Tate later explained in a video, "I'm not a fucking rapist, but I like to be able to do whatever I want." During my visit, the Tates strenuously denied that they had hurt a single woman. "I've never done anything wrong in my life," Andrew told me. He insisted that none of the women he'd recruited had accused him of crimes, adding, "They're still my friends." By the time police raided his properties, he said, the webcam business, which, by the way, is not illegal, had been closed for 10 years. He showed no trace of emotion as he lied. In Romania, the Tates turned their small-time webcam enterprise into a kind of industrial operation. Their approach to recruiting resembled what trafficking experts called the lover boy method. They trawled dating apps and social media for young women, blasting out hundreds of identical messages and frequently changing their locations to expand their reach. Women who responded were romanced. Tate sent one flurry of questions. Where did she want to travel? Had she ever been skydiving? Had she ever seen a Dubai sunset? Those who proved susceptible were groomed for sex work. Every day I sent 20 Instagrams. Every day I was on a date. I was fucking 4 girls, 5 girls a week, Tate said in a War Room video. I built my business off the back of my dick. Tate had learned from Ken Ivey, the Pimpology author, the importance of having a bottom bitch. He needed a recruiting sergeant who could lure in other women, and he assigned this role to Hrkova. After he slept with a woman, Hrkova would come in to sell the dream of webcam work, he explained in a War Room video. Before this, I was a waitress, and it was shit, he coached her to say. Now I do this, I make so much money. In fact, Tate said, Hrkova said, saw little of the money she generated. He reported in private chats that her live streams had made him around $2 million, but all she got was pocket money for coffee and manicures. She works hard to please me, to get attention, he said. He was certain that she would never leave him. I own her mind, he told associates. If I died, she would commit suicide. One worker from that time told me that Hrkova seemed to have lost the capacity for independent thought. She's not herself. She's like an extension of Andrew, she said. We were all brainwashed. After the initial pitch, Tate would get his target and Hrkova drunk and have sex with them. Martinis, 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 bam, threesome. Slam them both, he said. That's how you recruit. The compulsory group sex continued once the women were employed. Every day after work for me was a threesome, foursome, fivesome orgy, Tate said. He wrote to one 18-year-old about a 3-year-old with Hrkova. You can be little sisters and hold hands while you get dick. The women lived in the brothers' properties, and the most prized workers were not allowed to go out unattended or to have relationships with anyone but the Tates. Otherwise, Andrew explained, then that other person she's fucking is going to have the control over her mind. Each brother had a personal harem. Tate called the women his wives and ordered them to address him as king. Often the recruits came from troubled homes or were living in poverty. One former member of Tate's harem told me that she had found his initial love bombing intoxicating. You go along with it, and before you know it, you're in absolute hell. Tate had a way of casually peppering the abuse through day-to-day life, she said. He kind of serves it to you in a tongue-in-cheek, humorous way, but it's deadly serious. Physical abuse was often disguised as rough sex. Once, she said, Tate beat her so hard that she sustained lasting injuries to her eye and breast. You're a sexually violent person, she texted him afterwards. He replied, you never told me to stop. In Romania, Tate rarely seemed to face consequences for his actions. In the summer of 2016, though, he risked returning to the UK to appear on the reality show Big Brother. People who had seen his early sex shows with Herskovo remembered him, and some of the footage was leaked online. In one video, Tate lay on a bed and ordered Herskova to show the camera her tattoo. "Why does it say Tate?" he asked. "Because I'm his whore," she replied. "Why's your ass got a bruise on it?" "Because my daddy hits me." Tate picked up a belt and began whipping Herskova as she lay in the fetal position sobbing. "Bitch, look at the camera," he told her, yanking her head back by the hair. "This is what happens when you don't fucking listen." The Sun, a leading tabloid, reported on the footage, and Tate was forced out of the Big Brother house. He posted a protest online. "We were having a laugh. The Sun are morons." He said that Herskova was an ex-girlfriend and shared a photo of her holding a belt inscribed with the words, "But I love when Andrew spanks me." In fact, Tate's removal from Big Brother had nothing to do with the videos. The Hertfordshire police had contacted the producers to inform them of the assault allegations from Navarro, Walker, and Price. But officers apparently missed indications of another crime, child pornography. Tate said that the belt video was made in 2012 at the start of his relationship with Herskova. That year, she turned 15. As the webcam business expanded, a British entrepreneur named Naomi John was brought in to help. John had grown up in Bedfordshire, not far from the Tates, and as a young woman, had opened a swimwear shop called Sandstorm Boutique. The store became a sponsor of the Miss World Beauty Pageant, and John served as a judge for the Miss Universe Great Britain, a significant recruiting pipeline for models. In 2016, the Tates persuaded John to move to Bucharest. They had launched a recruitment agency called Model Stars, and they wanted their role in it to be obscured. Model Stars was described in promotional materials as an all-female business in which women help other women to escape the 9-to-5 work schedule and earn life-changing amounts of money. John's job, according to sealed court filings and interviews with women who worked for her, was to help recruit webcam workers and control their profiles on streaming sites. "I don't want them to have passwords," Tristan texted John. "I want the money to be used by me and you. Fuck them." John directed the women on camera, telling them which positions to adopt and which sex toys to use. "She was the brain and I was the looks," one recruit told me. Another worker in her late teens, with pink hair and braces, was renamed Chloe Skittles and posed in a room with jars of candy above the bed. One of John's first recruits, Abigail Tyson, was working in a bathroom supply store in the struggling English port town of Grimsby when she got an Instagram message from Model Stars. Tyson told me that she spoke to John over Skype and found her really lovely, like a friend that I've known for a long time. The shop paid about £300 a week. John assured her she would earn much more from Model Stars. In Bucharest, Tyson was brought to a house where the brothers were staying with several other women. She never had a serious boyfriend, and she was mesmerized by Tristan. "I've never met someone who is so intelligent like him," she said. They soon started sleeping together. Tyson proved to be a relentlessly hard worker, streaming for 17 hours straight and sometimes performing live sex shows with Herskova. Tristan described her in private messages as his main income, adding that after several years she was still in the dark about how much money her streams made. According to court filings, she went on to earn him close to $1 million. She also bore him a child. Tyson is one of several former workers Tristan put me in touch with, saying that they would vouch for his innocence. Talking to me over Zoom while her five-year-old daughter with Tristan played in the background, Tyson told me that the Tates were just big cuddly teddy bears. The other women Tristan recommended also rejected the idea that they were victims. But even one of the Tates defenders described Tristan as behaving like a dictator and said that When she decided to leave, he attacked her verbally and hacked her social media accounts. One of her associates threatened to set fire to her car. The Tate's messages show that they repeatedly ordered associates to punish women by hijacking their social media accounts and posting pornographic images of them to their followers. When another worker fled the operation, Tristan told Naomi John to log in to her Instagram account and burn it down. "Cool, I felt like burning stuff down," John replied. At the peak of the webcam business, the brothers reported they had 75 women working for them. Andrew said that more than 30 women had his name tattooed on their skin. John returned to the UK and established a webcam house for the brothers in Hertfordshire. She couldn't be reached for comment, and it is unclear how much she knew about the Tate's recruitment methods. But several women who worked for the operation offered the same theory about her motivations. "Obviously, she was benefiting from it. She got her percentage," one said. "But I'm pretty sure she was in love with Andrew and trying to please him." At one point, Tate's messages show he recorded a video about only seeing a girl part-time but loving her, and sent it to 9 women, leading each to believe that it was exclusively for her. The names attached to the women's numbers in his phone included Jackass, Useless, Crazy Bitch, and Naomi. Tate flaunted his growing wealth on social media, and a following coalesced. He showed a gift for pop culture provocation, with posts that often went to the top of the trending charts. One of his first viral sensations started with a series of jibes at fans of Star Wars. "Everyone who's ever watched Star Wars in human history is absolutely dirt poor," he posted, alongside a photograph of himself on a yacht. "Even watching a Star Wars trailer may leave you homeless, on the street with AIDS." Tate also taunted vegetarians, "The souls of dead animals power my massive wang. Lovers of Japanese cuisine, you know who eats sushi? Little fucking soy boys, little fucking Democrats, and people who preferred to drink still water. You scared of bubbles, you little bitch?" His fans looked to him for entertainment, but also for inspiration. Tate projected a credo of masculine excellence that revolved around self-discipline, physical prowess, and mental fortitude. He insisted that depression isn't real, and told sufferers to stop complaining and start working out. For a young man feeling dejected by the public conversation about toxic masculinity, Tate's celebrations of manhood were galvanizing, and his mocking assaults on feminism felt bracingly irreverent. "The reason feminists think men are losers is because the only men that bother to interact with feminists are losers," he posted. At the height of the hashtag MeToo movement, Tate tweeted that women should bear some responsibility for being sexually assaulted. During the controversy that followed, his disdain for women began cohering into a political identity. He appeared on InfoWars and then on at the Conservative Political Action Conference, where he was photographed with Candace Owens, the right-wing television personality, Jack Posobiec, and the far-right British politician Nigel Farage. After the 2016 election, Tate had posted a string of pro-MAGA tweets, and he began messaging with Donald Trump Jr. Eventually, he secured an invitation to Trump Tower. That was the first time he had ever had any kind of interaction with anyone that big, his former harem member told me. It was like a drug to him. After the visit, he posted a photograph of himself in a gold-embroidered blazer, clasping hands with a grinning Trump Jr. He wrote, "The Tate family support Trump fully, MAGA." Tate started selling an online course called Network Brilliance, in which he declared, "I have access to the president's son and claim to know every big person in politics on the right." Tate's longest-standing political connection was to Tommy Robinson, a far-right agitator whose Islamophobic rhetoric and inflammatory claims about Asian sex grooming gangs have stoked violent unrest across several British cities. Robinson also grew up in Luton, and he and Tate knew each other well. Tate was intrigued by one of Robinson's allies, the Canadian activist Laura Southern. She had become a darling of the manosphere at the age of 19 with a video titled Why I Am Not a Feminist, in which she argued that men were the real victims of an unjust society. She followed up with a series of videos in which she trolled women who marched against sexual violence, ridiculing their views, and holding up a sign saying, "There is no rape culture in the West." In February 2018, Tate asked Robinson to bring Southern to Romania to discuss a business venture. She told me that she flew to Bucharest without knowing much about Tate. Robinson had simply said that a kickboxer in Eastern Europe wanted to finance her work. When they arrived, Tate was awaiting in one of his supercars, and he insisted on taking her out for lunch alone. Over steak, he told her everything that you would want to hear as a conservative right-wing woman, talking about the importance of family and praising her work. "You're saving Western civilization," she remembers him saying. After lunch, they headed to Tate's compound. At a long table, Southern listened as the brothers laid out their proposal. They would fund a new right-wing media venture, with her and Robinson in charge, if she would use it to pump a cryptocurrency that they were planning to launch. The idea, she recalls, was basically, "We're going to create a European nationalist outlet to fleece all those idiots for money." That evening, the Tates took Southern to a club where they ordered bottle service. After a couple of shots of vodka, she recalls, "She suddenly felt like my consciousness was collapsing." Tate carried her to his car, where she came to. They were on the bed at her hotel. Tate started kissing Southern and pulling off her clothes. She told me that she tried to push his hands away, but he wouldn't stop. Then he hooked his arm around her neck and started to squeeze. She remembers thinking, "Oh shit, this guy is actually going to rape me." Southern was anti-abortion and was terrified of getting pregnant. She began pleading with him, "I know what you're going to do here. Please just wear a condom, please." Southern remembers fading in and out of consciousness as Tate raped her unprotected and choked her. Afterward, he sat on the edge of the bed and said, "Don't tell the press I raped you." She remembers saying, "My whole brand is literally talking about how stupid bitches get themselves into situations like this. There's nothing I can say without destroying my career, so congratulations." And that's all we have time for today. Heidi Blake is an investigative reporter for The New Yorker based in the UK. She has also hosted the podcast series Blood Relatives Within the Dark. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.